Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sports Tonight on BSL Radio. Join Rob Shields and Mike Weber as they talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, University of Maryland Terrapins, and more. Be part of the show. Call us at 347-215-8391.
Welcome to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. Mike Weber here with Rob Shields. Tonight we have a bevy of guests on. Scott Wright from Draft Countdown, Nick Falaris from Baseball Prospectus, and Mike Pinna from Sports on Earth, Grantland, a bunch of sites. He writes for, you know, a ton of sites, so hard to really pin him down to just one or two sites. But he's an NBA guy, Nick Falaris, of course, baseball, and Scott Wright, NFL Draft. Tonight, actually, just to get a little, programming note out of the way, or whatever you want to call it, this will be my final show, my final time on this show. If it continues, obviously, the name would change somewhat, but unless, you know, there's another guy named Mike as my replacement lined up. But it's to be determined if Rob will continue the show with, you know, someone else. But we shall see. Obviously, that information will be on BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com, an excellent site if you haven't checked it out for whatever reason and you somehow have come across this show. Check that site out for Baltimore sports. Good discussion, you know, national sports-wise as well, a lot of good articles and so forth. And some of those articles come from Rob Shields, who writes Orioles articles. So, Rob, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Mike, how are you?
Not bad. All right, so let's start off with NBA playoffs as well as the MVP. So NBA playoffs starting Saturday. You know, let's start off with the MVP first. MVP, this is a very competitive MVP race. A lot of, you know, disagreement on who should get the MVP. I think the main two guys, it seems to be coming down to, at least in terms of the media, are going to be Stephen Curry and James Harden. So it's, you know, again, a very competitive race. You know, you have the, you know, the best player on the best team argument with Steph Curry. The Warriors are by far the best team, at least regular season-wise. We'll get into if we think they will be in the playoffs. But easily the best team this regular season, really a historically great team. This is, I mean, I think some people are, I think, becoming more and more aware of this as certain media types push this element of the season out late. But the Warriors are one of the best, like, 10 or so teams probably in our regular season history in terms of record, 67-15, point differential, plus 10. So that's tremendous. So you have the best player on the best team argument, and a guy who's, like, legitimately great statistically and just watching him, however you want to measure it, versus, you know, the guy who, in a lot of people's minds, have carried his team the most, James Harden of the Rockets. Rockets finished 56-26 to get the number 2 seed in the West in a very compacted West there. If they won 55 games, they could have been the 5th or 6th seed, depending on, I don't know how the tiebreakers exactly would have worked out. But his team is clearly not as good as Steph Curry's team. Of course, you have the win differential there to justify that. But the Houston Rockets, just not really a sexy team otherwise. You had Dwight Howard, of course, but he missed a lot of games this year due to injury, and he's also declining. So I think those are the two main guys people talk about. Now, however, you also have Russell Westbrook, what he's done with the Thunder. Of course, they have just come up short of the playoffs. Season with Kevin Durant missing a ton of time, Ibaka missing time, and Russell missing some time himself. So you have him, you have Anthony Davis, like an all-time historic PER this year, but he's missed some time. Pelicans do make the playoffs, though. You have Chris Paul, you know, the steady rock of the Clippers, who won the same amount of games as the Rockets, 56. And, of course, LeBron James, a guy who's still generally considered to be the best player in the league. So Rob, but he missed some time as well. The sabbatical, I guess some people are calling it. So, Rob, what are your thoughts on this deep MVP race?
You know, it's definitely this is a pretty close race to me. I think if you it's tough how you want to take that argument of, well, if you take this player off of the team, you know, how bad is that team going to be? Harden, as you said, has definitely been a guy that has had to carry his team more so than Curry did. But, you know, the thing about Curry, he kind of makes that team go in a lot of ways because their style of play and things like that. Neither one of these guys are great defensive players, so there's not really some kind of, well, you know, they're giving you a whole lot more on the other end. PER, Curry is ahead of him. It's not a huge difference, but he's ahead of him. I think I lean towards Curry. I mean, here's the thing. You know, when you look at, if you were to look at points per game, just picking a statistic, Curry could average a lot more points a game than he does. He just happens to have a lot more shooters on his team and a lot more scores. So just because if Harden averages, you know, Harden's averaging almost 4 points a game more than he is, but, you know, but he's doing it because he has to, not being Curry could if he needed to. Curry shooting, you know, for a guy who's, you know, basically a jump shooter, Curry's shooting, you know, 48% from the field. Actually, it's almost 49%, actually. He's shooting 91% from the free throw line. He's shooting 44% from three. So he's shooting the ball, you know, in comparison to Harden. Harden is shooting 44% from the field. He's shooting 87% from the line and 37% from three. So Curry is shooting better. He's making his he's kind of the main cog in that team to make that team go. So I think it's close, and I don't think it's horrible to think it should go to Harden, but I would lean Curry in this situation.
Yeah, I would go with Curry myself, and I'm not, like, tremendously into the, you know, the best player, best team type of argument, but I think he's probably slightly better than Harden and at least as important. Yeah, we talk about Harden, you know, carrying his team more. That may be so, but Steph Curry actually has the better NBA Real Plus Minus, which you can find on ESPN.com. It's not by a landslide, it's very close, but Steph Curry leads the league in that. Harden is third. LeBron, by the way, fourth. Anthony Davis, fifth. Chris Paul, sixth. Russell Wilson, seventh. So, you know, the Warriors' offense drastically decreases without him. His shooting is, you know, historically amazing. And it really just makes that offense go. He's a respectable defensive player as well. Harden has made a much more of an effort this year, too, after basically being a laughingstock the last year or two. But Curry, I think, you know, is not necessarily the best player, but he's the best player who has played basically the whole season. You could argue LeBron's better and Anthony Davis is better. But and maybe Westbrook, maybe he's better too. But these guys have missed all 15-plus games. So I think that is huge. Now, one big argument for Harden is he's played more minutes. But some of that's just out of necessity, or a lot of it's out of necessity. Curry gets to sit out a lot in the fourth quarter because the Warriors are just running people off the court. Harden does not get that same advantage of sitting out. So are you going to really penalize Curry because the team's blowing out other teams? No, I wouldn't do that. Now, you do have to give Harden some credit for having to play those extra minutes and carrying his team in clutch moments, which he's done a very good job of. But, yeah, overall, I would go with Curry. But, you know, after him and Harden, I think all those other guys are, you know, relatively worthy candidates. The games missed is the biggest thing with all those guys, except for Chris Paul, who's had a big MVP type season as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for what I'm seeing, you know, just at a quick glance here, Anthony Davis, you can argue that Anthony Davis is the real MVP in terms of just pure numbers and what he means to his team, because I don't think that team is really that great around him. But he's, you know, got him into the playoffs and everything else. And, you know, if he didn't miss those games, they probably would have comfortably been in the playoffs. Westbrook is right behind him in PER, ahead of both Harden and Curry. Some of that, again, probably has to do with minutes. But, you know, the thing with Westbrook, you know, he's had an amazing season, okay? But he's shooting 43% almost from the field. So to me, you have to dock him a little bit for that. It might be a minor thing, but you know, when you're trying to figure out like who's the better guy in an MVP race, that there isn't a clear cut winner this year. You have to pick apart little things here and there to figure out why you would take this guy over that guy. And Westbrook is a high volume shooter, shooting more than these other guys are. And he's making less of them as a percentage. So I think that has to be taken into account when you're discussing this. But, you know, but I would agree with you. I think there are at least five guys that are worthy candidates for this award this year. Really, nobody's even mentioning LeBron. LeBron probably is the MVP if you take out the idea of you eliminate Westbrook and Davis because of the injury time. You can probably make the car argument. I mean, LeBron has helped get that team together. They looked terrible earlier in the season, and now they look like they could be the favorite in the East. So, you know, you could really make the argument that he's really the true MVP, and he probably is most years that he's in the league, just like Jordan was. But, but he's just, for whatever reason, whether it's just because people don't want to give it to him or whatever, he's not really being brought up that much. So I think it will come down to Harden versus Curry, and I do think that the best player on best team argument is what will get him in, even though I do agree with you that that's not necessarily the reason he should get it.
Yeah, as far as LeBron's concerned, you're talking, you know, about a guy who is, of course, an amazing player. He did take the time off, and his stats are down some this year. So that has to be taken into consideration. But if you're just talking value, and this is a kind of somewhat more easy to measure, because, hey, he was on the Miami Heat last year. Miami Heat last year were in the NBA Finals, of course. The Cleveland Cavaliers had the first pick in the draft, Andrew Wiggins. Of course, they traded for Kevin Love. This year, Cleveland Cavaliers, 53 wins. And they got to go into coast mode at the end, so they could have won a little bit more. So, you know, that's just in terms of franchise changing ability, I mean, that's pretty epic. So, yeah, you could argue him. I think the games missed there is a huge argument against them. And just real quick on Harden versus Curry again, you know, people talk about how, you know, if Harden wasn't on the Rockets, they wouldn't make the playoffs and the Warriors would make the playoffs. And I think that's likely true. However, I think the leap from being a good or very good team to being an elite team is harder to make than the leap from being like an average-ish team to being a good or even very good team. And that's what the Warriors are. They're elite, historically elite, as I mentioned. So that's just incredibly difficult to get to that level, and Curry is the biggest reason for that. But let's move on. We don't have a ton of time until Scott Wright comes on. Let's talk a little bit of playoffs. I think the East, I don't think there's any reason really to talk about the first round. Of course, the Wizards are our semi-local team here, playing the Raptors, but whoever wins that is going to lose to the Hawks, in my opinion. Cleveland is going to win their first round series. I think the Bulls will win as well. So you end up having what could be an interesting series with the Bulls and Cavs. I think Cavs probably win. And then you end up with the Cavs and the Hawks in all likelihood, because I think the Hawks, again, beat whoever wins the Wizards-Raptors series. So I don't think it's that interesting, the East, until you get to the Eastern Conference Finals. Do you think there is another team that really has a good chance there, Rob? Or if those two teams are the very likely teams in your mind, who do you think comes out of the East?
I mean, they're the very likely teams, but, you know, I do think the Bulls are a wild card in this. You know, what is Derrick Rose going to give you? I think if the Bulls were the four seed, it came near the end, they could have been the four and Toronto the three. If I were the Bulls, I'd have rather been playing Atlanta than playing Cleveland. just purely for the fact that, you know, I mean, and this kind of impacts, obviously, the Cleveland series, too. The Cephalosha injury is a big deal. You know, they talk about it, that he'd been the guy that they would have put on LeBron and, you know, that type of stuff. So it's a big deal. So you're facing Atlanta when maybe they're not going to be at their strongest. So I think Toronto could probably push Atlanta. I think there's even a chance that the Wizards could. And when I say push, I mean six, maybe a potential seven. I don't think they would win, but I think they could, you know, I don't think Atlanta's just going to roll over them. But I think it's all about Cleveland and Atlanta to me, and really I actually would be, I don't want to say the word surprise because it's not really the right word, but I would give Atlanta maybe only like a 30-40% chance at the most to win that series. So I think it's Cleveland, and I don't really feel that it's that difficult of a decision to pick them.
I'm a little bit more torn on that. Now you have, you know, the Thabo injury that you mentioned. Paul Millsap has a shoulder issue, so we'll see if he can be 100% at least by the time that series comes around. That's a huge issue if he's one of their best players. But I do think it's, you know, relatively close series, and I would be interested to see, you know, the ultimate team concept that the Hawks bring, you know, which we saw destroy the Heat last year. But of course, that came from the Spurs, a much more battle-tested team and all that. Potentially a more talented team, even though this Hawks team does have pretty good talent. I think it's underrated. So I am curious to see, you know, how that clash works. Cavaliers are still a pretty heavy ISO team, so that can be difficult to, you know, win a championship with, especially nowadays with the stronger defenses, the Thibodeau-style defenses. But I will pick the Cavs primarily because of LeBron, of course. Also, they've just been really good since their moves, getting Mozgov, J.R. Smith. That was the key to this whole season, at least in the Eastern Conference, was those trades. I also got Iman Shumpert, of course. All right, so let's talk briefly about the West. Maybe we'll talk briefly about this after Mike Pinna comes on too. But you have a ridiculous first round series, I think, with the Spurs and the Clippers. I think that's by far the best matchup of the first round. The only potential problem with this is we could see a lot of Hakka DJ Jordan, which totally sucks. And, you know, for me at least, I understand that, you know, it's a worthwhile strategy. I just kind of wish for the entertainment purposes of the sport it wasn't allowed. But otherwise, that series is quite amazing. I feel really bad for the Clippers that they got this series because, you know, it's kind of unfair based on, you know, how well they did, and they end up with the defending champs who have been playing tremendously well lately in that first round. And if they lose this series, I'm going to feel really bad for Chris Paul, because then it's more ammunition of like, oh, Chris Paul can't get it done in the playoffs, blah, blah, blah. Well, all right, maybe that's somewhat valid, but if they were in the East, they would be a strong contender to at least make the Eastern Conference Finals and have a decent chance of making the finals. And if they were playing any other team in the first round, besides, of course, the Warriors, which there would be no chance of them playing them, I'd easily take the Clippers, I think, in the first round. But this series, I'm going to have to go Spurs, just based on how well they've been playing, experience. I think Kawhi Leonard is going to end up on Chris Paul a fair amount, because there's no other wing on the Clippers, with the exception of Jamal Crawford from time to time, and he's banged up, that Kawhi Leonard would have to be on. There's no reason for him to really be on J.J. Redick or Matt Barnes much, because they're just spot-up shooters. So you can see Kawhi and Danny Green, who's also an excellent defender, getting a lot of time on Chris Paul. Chris Paul is, of course, the engine that makes that offense work. And if you put those guys on him, that's going to really, I think, affect how well CP3 does. And the Spurs are just, you know, they have a beautiful offense. The Clippers, their bench is extremely limited. So I'm going Spurs in that pivotal first round series there.
Yeah, I heard Stephen A. Smith was on Mike and Mike the other day, and he was talking about how Kawhi Leonard is going to be so key in every series, because depending on the teams that they play, because this was before the seedings were set. So, you know, he talked about that, you know, he would be able to play Chris Paul. They would put him on Steph Curry. you know, so those two guys alone, that's really dangerous. And you know, this is interesting. I think San Antonio is actually happy getting the sixth seed. First of all, if they had gotten the second seed, they would have had to play Dallas, and Dallas always plays them tight. I mean, they took them the seven games last year. they always play them very well. And then the other thing is, which would have been the case if they had, this would have been the case if they were the two seed, but I think they would have rather been the sixth than, say, the four or the five as well, because I heard the point made today, and I hadn't thought about it, but I thought it was a really good point. The later that you play Golden State, maybe the little bit better it is, because they're a jump-shooting team, and maybe they get a little bit more tired as the playoffs go on. So it's interesting. I would think from the Spurs' point of view, they would rather play the Warriors in the conference finals, and they would rather not play Dallas, who plays them, even though the Clippers are a better team than Dallas. but that doesn't necessarily mean that the matchup or, you know, whatever you want to talk about is more in favor, you know, for the Clippers than it is for Dallas. So I think San Antonio is not upset at all with the fact that they ended up as a sixth seed.
Well, I disagree with a lot of that in terms of the seeding and all that, but we can maybe touch on that towards the end of the show. Let's switch gears here. Welcome Scott Wright from Draft Countdown. Talk some NFL draft. How you doing tonight, Scott?
Hey, guys. I'm doing excellent. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure, Scott. So, you know, we're a Baltimore-based show here, so we're going to, you know, focus on the Ravens, of course. So, thoughts on, you got Gurley versus Gordon as running back options, potentially in round one. If, you know, they're both available there for the Ravens, who do you think would be the better fit for the Ravens, and do you think that they should draft one of them?
Well, I would bet against either of them being there, especially Gurley. I think Gurley's going to go in the top 15 to 20, but assuming they did have their choice between both, I think you go Gurley. And Gurley, to put in perspective what special talent this guy is, he's in an era where his position's been devalued. He's coming off a major knee injury, has other injury issues in his past, yet he's still probably going to go in the top 20 overall. I think really speaks volumes. And I have him as one of the top five most talented players in this entire class. Now, philosophically, I would never take a running back that early because I think you can get productive runners later on, especially in this class where running back is one of the deepest positions in this draft. And I really think the sweet spot for running back value is round three, round four, round five. But if for some reason Gurley did fall into Ozzie Newsome's lap, I think he'd be all over Gurley.
When you're comparing Gurley to Melvin Gordon, what stands out to you as the reason that you would say that Gurley is the more talented back?
I think Gurley has a little better vision. I think he's a little bit more of a physical runner, especially between the tacks, whereas Gordon, I think, is a little too in love with bouncing things outside at times. And that's not uncommon for college running backs, and you can get away with that but in college, but you can't necessarily get away with it as much in the NFL. So I think Gurley, and at the end of the day, I just think Gurley's on another level. I think he's a special talent. I think he's very much in that same class as and granted, some of these guys I'm going to mention didn't work out, but the Adrian Petersons, the Darren McFadden's, the Trent Richardson's, you know, just top five, top 10 overall type of talent. And honestly, if Gurley hadn't blown out his knee, I'm not so sure he wouldn't have gotten in the top 10 overall of this draft. And that's saying something in this day and age.
Okay, Scott, let's move to the wide receivers. This is a position that the Ravens, you know, pretty desperately need at this point. They lost Torrey Smith. Steve Smith is getting older. They've got some intriguing young players, but they could certainly use some more talent. If we're to assume that Amari Cooper's gone, Kevin White is gone, and that Devontae Parker doesn't drop to the point where the Ravens think about trading up for him, of the guys after those three that are potentially going to be available, who stands out to you as a guy that could be, you know, a maybe not a number one, but, you know, an upper echelon receiver in the league?
Well, in years past, I would say that Ozzie Newsome would sit back and be drooling at the thought of maybe someone like Dorial Beckham from Oklahoma falling into his lap as a wide receiver, but other positions, Marcus Peters from Washington, maybe Randy Gregory from Nebraska. But after the Ray Rice situation, I just don't think it's going to be tenable for the Ravens to take that kind of chance this year. So one example of obviously being the team that Ray Rice played for, the Ravens are going to be affected more than others. But I think that's just one example of how off-the-field concerns could play a much larger role in this draft than they have in years past. And I think that's one of the big interesting storylines that I'm interested to see how it plays out with the 2015 NFL draft. So I think Dorial Green-Beckham is going to be off their board probably, but who knows, maybe Breshad Perriman from Central Florida is there, maybe Jalen Strong from Arizona State, maybe Nelson Aguilar from USC, but even in round two, one thing that struck me while working on my latest mock draft is the tremendous value that's going to be on the board late in the second round, to the point where teams in my mock draft were getting guys late in round two that they were considering late in round one. the Ravens. I have them taking Devin Smith from Ohio State in round two, who I think would be a perfect replacement for Torrey Smith as that vertical threat in this class. Sammy Coates from Auburn could be another guy in the mix. Philip Dorsett from Miami. But even going into round three, Justin Hardy from East Carolina, who I'm a big fan of, Lockett from Kansas State. There's really good depth at wide receiver in this class. Not quite up to the standards of last year's almost historic crop, but still pretty darn good, to the point where I think you're going to get a second-round talent in the third round, a third-round talent in the fourth round. So I wouldn't fault the Ravens at all for addressing another need first and then waiting on a wideout, even though that is a huge need. I just would want to take advantage of that value this year, unless somebody really good falls into your lap.
One of the one of our writers on our site just recently did a kind of comparison article on Jalen Strong and Devin Smith. There's actually two guys, and they were kind of taking opposing viewpoints. When you're looking at those two players and you're comparing the two of them, which one of those guys stands out to you as the better prospect?
I would side with Jalen Strong just because I think he's a more well-rounded prospect. And Jalen Strong was one of the guys who really helped himself at the scouting combine. I always say more often than not, 9 times out of 10, guys perform about how we expect them to perform. But Jalen Strong was one of those exceptions this year. When he ran that 4.44, time speed was one of the big knocks on Jalen Strong. Now, I don't believe he plays quite that fast, whereas Devin Smith, who ran a similar 40 time, definitely plays that fast. But Jalen Strong, that definitely helps alleviate those concerns, and a terrific all-around player. He's got great size. He's 6'2.5", 217 pounds, excellent body control, ball skills, reliable hands, very productive in both of his seasons at Arizona State. So Jalen Strong, I wouldn't even be shocked if he snuck into the top 20 overall. I have him going to Philly, actually, in my most recent mock draft, and there's just so many teams in the middle of the first round that could be looking for a wideout, starting with the Rams at 10, the Vikings, the Browns, the Saints, the Dolphins, maybe the Niners, the Texans, the Chiefs, maybe the Eagles. So I think we could see that run on the second tier pass catchers start a little earlier than expected. And I think guys like Strong and Breshad Perriman from Central Florida would be the beneficiaries of that.
Is there some talk that Strong actually had played with a fractured wrist in the second half of the season. Is there a concern there for you on how that could affect his ability long-term catching the ball, or if he needs surgery and he could miss some time this coming year?
Yeah, well, it's always a concern, and I always say that this is where independent draft analysts are at the biggest disadvantage. We're just not privy to the private medical information and access to the doctors to break it down and give us a read on if it's going to be a short-term concern, a long-term, et cetera. But Strong, I think, said it's old news. He said he heard it in early November and he played with it, and he played extremely well with it, if that's the case. And I'm sure the teams are aware of it. I don't think this is coming out of left field for the teams. They've done their due diligence by this point. So I don't see it impacting his grade that much, but whenever, usually the vast majority of the time when somebody slides a lot further in the draft than expected, it's because of some unknown medical thing that we don't know of. So it's always a little bit of a concern, and it definitely throws it a little bit more into question, but I would still bet on Strong being a first round pick when all is said and done.
And the last question on the wide receivers, one of the things that the Ravens have struggled on is red zone offense. And you know, so they need somebody in terms of being able to make contested catches, things like that. How much do scouts look at guys in terms of their ability to make a contested catch, and how high do they rate that ability on, you know, on whatever their measurables are?
I think it varies team by team. I think everybody looks for different traits, but I know if I were in charge, I would place a very high value in that ability to compete for those 50-50 balls, because we all know that in the NFL, you're not running wide open very often, and you want a guy who's going to win it when it's a coin flip. So, you know, if that's the type of player they're looking for, the first name I would mention normally would be Doriel Green Beckham, who at 6'5", 237 pounds, is basically built like a tight end, but he runs a sub 4.5, and Doriel Green Beckham is arguably a top 10 overall talent who could go anywhere from the middle of the first round to late round two. I think it's that wide of a range for him, especially in this class where we're not exactly sure how maybe a renewed interest on character could affect guys. But I also think Jalen Strong would qualify if you're looking for that type of player, and Rashad Perriman from Central Florida, who I've compared to Dwayne Bowe, but with speed. So I think if that's the type of player you're looking for, I think it might behoove you to do it in the first round, because I think once you get to the second and third round, you're looking at mostly vertical threats, slot guys, number two, number three options. So if you're looking for that big physical specimen at wideout, you might have to do it at 26.
Scott, what are your thoughts on this cornerback class, and specifically after Waynes, how many guys stand out to you as first rounders?
I think it's lacking in quality, but it compensates with quantity. And Trey Waynes from Michigan State is going to be the first guy off the board. I think very possibly somewhere in the top 10 overall, certainly within, I think, the top 11. But then there's a drop-off. And then after that, I think it's going to get somewhat subjective. I'm not so sure there's going to be a consensus in terms of cornerbacks, say, 2 through 8. I think it's going to be a case of beauty in the eye of the beholder, and they all bring different qualities to the table. Now, if not for character concerns, I think Marcus Peters from Washington would be number two, although I don't think this is even a similar situation to even Doriel Green Beckham. Marcus Peters is a very good player, but he's not a special talent. I think there's other second-tier corners that are comparable in talent that I would be inclined to go in another direction, whether it be a Jalen Collins from LSU, a Quentin Rollins from Miami, Ohio, Kevin Johnson from Wake Forest, who is actually who I have penciled into the Ravens in my latest mock draft. And then keep an eye, too, on two guys who are really rising and have a shot to sneak into the back end of the first round. Byron Jones from Connecticut, who, of course, had some fabulous workouts, but he's not just a workout warrior. He was always considered to be a legitimate day two talent, even before he blew everybody's minds with his in some cases, world-class workout results. He was just sliding under the radar a little bit because he was coming off a season-ending shoulder injury. And then Eric Rowe from Utah, another big defensive back who could project to either cornerback or safety. So there's going to be a lot of value at corner, and I think the Ravens, if they want to go that direction in round one, I think they're kind of in the perfect range to get one of those second-tier guys. And who knows, they might even be able to get the second-ranked corner on their board at that point.
Scott, when we talk about, like you're talking about corners, and, you know, for the Ravens, if they want a specific corner to fit a specific scheme. So when a team is evaluating the prospects that they have, how important how much do they emphasize the scheme that they're actually playing?
Oh, it's a huge factor. And that's why I think draft boards around the league are a lot different than people realize. Because they're all looking for a different set through a different prism, because their situations are different. They value different traits, maybe based on whether it be their philosophy, whether it just be front office, coaching, what have you. So no question, that plays a huge role in it, and it's something you got to factor in when you're doing mock drafts. You know, when I do my rankings, I'm just trying to rate talent. I'm not building a draft board for any specific scheme. If I were, it would look dramatically different. Some guys wouldn't even be on the board at all, while some would be a lot higher. So no question, there's a lot of volatility from one draft board to the next around the league. And I think that's why we do see some big surprises on draft day. And that's what makes the NFL draft so fun. There isn't necessarily a right or wrong answer. Every team has a different way of doing it. And for some, it works out better than most. But the Baltimore Ravens and Ozzie Newsome seem to have a pretty good way of doing things. So I would have a lot of faith in their decision-making process by this point.
All right, Scott, last question for you here on the Ravens. Another position they could use is an edge rusher. Who do you think could be there for him in round one? And how good of a fit, or is there anyone that you would advocate them drafting in round one?
Yeah, and there's a lot of pass rushers in this class, but they're going to go early and often. Everyone's always looking for pass rushers. Now, like I said, in years past, I think Randy Gregory, if he were to somehow fall to number 26, That would be a prototypical Ozzie Newsome Baltimore Ravens type of move, but I just don't know if that's feasible this year. Some other edge pass rushers in that late first-round range. I think Shane Ray from Missouri could slide. He could be an option. I don't think he's going to go quite as high as a lot of people do. To me, he has a lot of the same warts that Michael Sam did in terms of his game. I had questions about his ability to play outside linebacker on fifth based on the film, and I think his disappointing workouts kind of confirmed those. And if he can't play on his feet, then he's a 4-3 pass rusher and really doesn't hold up all that well against the run. How early do you take a situational pass rusher in a 4-3 scheme? Also keep an eye on Eli Harrell from Virginia, who's in that on that late first-round, early second-round fringe. Owamabi Odigizuwa from UCLA would be a name to keep an eye on. Maybe even Mario Edwards from Florida State, who has some helium right now. But, yeah, like I say, if you need a pass rusher, you better get one in the first round, two, maybe three, because after that it falls off pretty quick. But I'm just not sure that that's going to be a first-round priority for the Ravens. With Doomerville, Suggs, Upshaw, I think the cover's not bare. They certainly need to add some young bodies and replenish that depth, but I just have to think wide receiver and cornerback are going to be much more pressing concerns for Baltimore.
And Scott, last question to get you out on. It has nothing to do with the Ravens. I'm curious, if you're Tampa Bay, which quarterback are you taking?
I'm taking Jameis Winston. And is it a risk? Sure, absolutely a risk. Marcus Mariota would be a risk for different reasons. Neither of these guys are Andrew Luck or Peyton Manning, and they don't come along very often. But Jameis Winston, this news about the lawsuit definitely isn't what his camp and the Buccaneers and the NFL want to see in the headlines a couple of weeks before the draft, but it's not unexpected. I think we knew this was coming. It was just a matter of when, and I'm sure it was factored into their evaluations. And if you are comfortable with Jameis Winston as a person, it's a really easy decision because I truly believe he's a transcendent type talent. I think if he hadn't have the character concerns, he would have my elite grade, which I'm very stingy with, and he'd be the third best quarterback prospect I've evaluated behind only Luck and Manning. And granted, it would be a distant third, but I think that highly of him. And the ironic thing with Winston is all the poor decision-making off the field there's been at times, on the field, he's the consummate field general. He's extremely intelligent. He's versed in a pro-style system. He's a hard worker. His teammates love him. He's a leader of men. He's got the ice water in his veins. So at the end of the day, Jameis Winston is the rarest of commodities, maybe the most valuable commodity in all of sports, which is a legitimate potential franchise quarterback. So teams are going to be willing to overlook a lot and concerned about football intangibles than they are about personal intangibles, and feel that if they can just help him mature off the field as a person and put a good support system in place, we're not going to have to worry about quarterback for the next decade and a half.
All right, Scott, thanks a lot for the time. You can be followed on Twitter at Draft Countdown. People can check out your website, draftcountdown.com. Of course, you have mock draft updated over there. You have your rankings. Anything else you want to mention before we let you go?
No, maybe just our podcast. You can check it out either through the site or on iTunes. It's called Draft Countdown. Really proud of it. So if you're into draft podcasts, check us out.
All right, great, Scott. Thanks again for the time, and have a great night.
It was my pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. All right, so Scott right there. We're going to have Nick Valeris joining us momentarily, talk some baseball with Nick. Yeah, Rob?
Mike, just to cut you off, Nick just sent me a text. He's calling in at 7:45, so he's calling in a couple minutes late.
All right, cool. So big takeaway there, Rob, from what Scott had to say.
I think I'm really hoping that the Ravens get a receiver. In round one, I feel that they need. I think what Scott said was actually very interesting about how in the first round or when you're going to be able to get your big bodied, go up and get it physical receivers, with the exception of maybe Dorial Beckham Green, who has the off the field issues. But putting that aside, that's where you want to get. And then in the later rounds. From second round and on is where you might get your Torrey Smith type guy, your Steve Smith guy, these deep vertical threat slot guys, stuff like that. I feel I would like, I mean, it ideally the Ravens, really in some ways, I wouldn't even mind them seeing taking two receivers and getting one of each of those types of guys. But I do really feel that they need to get a guy who is a big target for Flacco, somebody who's a good red zone threat. So it's going to be interesting to me to see, you know, what they're able to get. And then a guy like Perryman, you know, this is a guy, he's big, he's 6'3", he's like 220-ish, something like that, but he runs like a sub 4.440, so he might be able to give you a combination of both. But he's, you know, he went to a smaller school, he's a little more unknown, you know, maybe a boomer bust type guy. So I found that interesting. the Gurley versus Gordon discussion has been very prominent on our board. I'm higher on Gurley than I am on Gordon. I can see the argument that maybe Melvin Gordon is a little bit more of an explosive guy that can maybe give you that, you know, anytime he touches the ball, he could go for a touchdown type thing. but I don't necessarily know that I see him as the all-around back that I would put him ahead of Gurley. The problem is Gordon's not coming off of a major knee injury, and Gurley is. Me, personally, I wouldn't draft a running back in the first round. I say that, but I guess the only way that I would is if you could not make a trade and you absolutely had a talent on your board that was way ahead of anybody else you had. I wouldn't reach for a player just because they're not a running back in the first round. But generally speaking, I wouldn't want to take a running back. There's a lot of running backs that I like that will be later on in the draft that they'll be able to get. So it's going to be interesting. I personally don't think corner is the number one need like a lot of people do. I would rather see them find out if a fourth rounder could get him, Brandon Boykin from Philadelphia. There's rumors that he's available. If you can get him, he's already an established good young corner. He's in the last year of his contract, but that's okay. you know, I would rather go that route, I think, than drafting a corner early and maybe getting that corner at that point and then being able to concentrate on some offensive weapons earlier in the draft would be the way I would like to see the team go. But I'm, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not really going to argue with whatever they do because they do it better than anybody else does for the most part. So, you know, they certainly get that benefit of the doubt. But, you know, I thought Scott had a lot of good information. And I guess I should say that the one position that I would want maybe early on outside of the offense would be an edge rusher. If somebody was there that they really liked off the edge, because they're going to need that because they have to replace McPhee. And the other two guys, Suggs and Doomerville, are getting older.
All right. Good thoughts there, Rob. Let's move on to a team that you do not give the benefit of the doubt to, the Baltimore Orioles. Of course, we're going to get into them with Nick Flaherty in a few minutes here. He's from Baseball Perspectives. Gives some great insight about the whole team in general, and also especially on the prospects, since that's what he covers the most. But Orioles, we'll get into, you know, the situation with trading Ryan Webb to the Dodgers along with their 74th pick in the draft, just basically to unload the contract. Neither of us like that. We'll get into that with Nick. I just want to say my biggest couple, like, takeaways are so far this year, you know, we've only seen Ubaldo pitch once, but it was a really impressive start, and we both liked him coming into this year as a good bounce-back candidate. So if he can be anything like he was in that first start, then that would be fantastic for this team. And, you know, we don't know. It remains to be seen, because obviously his consistency hasn't been his strong suit in recent years. Even when he, you know, was dominant with the Indians to close out the season a couple years ago, he wasn't that great, you know, prior to that, for most of that season. All right, so there's that. Jonathan Scope has really been impressive with the bat so far. I was at the game last night, and he just crushed that home run. I mean, that was a hell of a shot from, you know, especially based on even the swing. It didn't look like, you know, he was trying to necessarily crush the ball. It's just, he just has tremendous pop off the bat. So those two things, you know, in terms of positives, I'll be positive here. Those are the two big positives I see. What do you have to say, Rob, before Nick comes on?
I'm looking forward to seeing how Ubaldo does tomorrow. He's facing another good offense, just like he did last week in Boston. You know, I think what you're seeing is a carryover from spring training. I think you're seeing a guy who had a full off season I think you're seeing somebody who realized he's making. I don't want to use the word minor because they're major in terms of how it's worked for him, but they are minor improvements in his mechanics. It's not like he totally went to a normal pitching, motion or anything. But not putting the hands above the head, kind of. If I'm relating that in a way to like a golf swing, it's kind of like your backswing. If you take your backswing back too far, you can sometimes start to lose it a little bit. So you shorten the backswing. It's kind of what he's done. He shortened the backswing, but he's not raising his hands as high. So I think that's good. Ramon Martinez seems like whatever he did with him has seemed like it's worked. So I don't expect him to be as good as he was, but I don't think it's out of the question. I like Dubaldo coming into this year strictly because if he gets the walks down, he's going to be fine. He doesn't get hit hard. He doesn't give up a ton of home runs. He's not somebody that's just getting smacked around the yard. He's giving games away every night last year. That's what happened. If he cuts down on the walks, he cuts down on the wild pitches, he cuts down on the hit batters, and he makes the other team beat him, he's going to be fine most of the time, and that's what the Orioles are hoping for, and that's what they should get if he's got his commander in control just a little bit better than it was last year.
Yeah, for sure. That's, of course, the key with him. Stuff, I don't know that it's necessarily overwhelming, but it is, quite good, I think. Like I said, Nick Flaherty will be joining us in a second. There's going on to the negative side, so we're just going to focus on some positive stuff. You have the trade of Webb and the draft pick, just because they're, I guess, cheap or whatever. It's hard to say exactly what their motive was, but money obviously was a big part of it. We're both quite upset about that. You just trade a decent pick, 74th or 6th, something like that, for, save $2.75 million. Now, you could argue that pick is not worth $2.75 million, but either way, it's a poor strategy long term, I think, and they should have that money available, but easily. And Webb's not even like a bad pitcher in my view, so you could have easily just been like, all right, hey, Garcia, our Rule 5 guy, who's not necessarily like incredibly impressive, let's just get rid of this guy because we're in a win now type of year. We'll get rid of him. Let Ryan Webb, be a part of this bullpen and keep the pick. I think that would have been perfectly fine, and I think Ryan Webb could have been useful, even if he's not necessarily going to have a great year.
Yeah, and, you essentially traded Jason Garcia for the 74th pick, and I think that's a loss of a trade. I don't see anything that's overly impressive about Garcia, like you said. The Orioles, I guess, in theory, saved $3.5 million on that deal because that slot for that pick is $800,000. To me, If that was a thought in your head, you don't tender a contract to Tommy Hunter. You let Ryan Webb have Tommy Hunter's bullpen spot, and you take that pick because there's not really going to be that much of a difference between Tommy Hunter and Ryan Webb. The ERA has been a little bit more on Tommy Hunter's side, but the FIP and the XFIP are better for Webb. Webb gets more ground balls. The K to walk ratios, all that kind of stuff is similar. There's not that much of a difference there. There just isn't. So you're spending more money on Tommy Hunter, and you're now losing a pick. Now, I do like the one pitcher that they got back in return. I think he's got a potential to help us, but he's a guy that you could have had in the offseason, you just didn't get him. So he's sitting out there for free. So if you really liked him, why didn't you just get him then? The Orioles will try to spin it that's what happened, and that's great. And maybe you got back two potential role players that could help you, maybe. But these are guys that are always available. There are always players like that available. You don't trade a commodity like a top 75 pick, and we'll find out from Nick how he feels about the depth of the draft and that type of stuff. But you don't trade a pick like that just so you can save a little bit money when you had other alternatives that you could have gotten those same players or players just like them for free, and you could have just kept Webb, or you could have non-tendered other contracts or traded some guys for salary relief or whatever and kept that pick. And you're a farm system that is not good. You've got some intriguing players but no real things, and you just gave away a top pick when you had a bunch of picks early in this draft. You could have really started to build something in your farm system, and you just threw it away just so you could save a couple of dollars, which is really all it is in the scheme of things in baseball.
All right, so speaking of Nick Flaherty from Baseball Prospectus, Let's welcome him to the show. How you doing tonight, Nick?
All right, guys. How's it going? Sorry for the background noise. I'm at the field, so you're going to hear a little bit of noise.
All right. No problem at all, Nick. Thanks, obviously, for joining us. So you may have heard Rob talking. We're talking about the Orioles basically trading the 74th overall pick to the Dodgers just so they can unload Brandon Webb. What are your thoughts on that deal?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clearly a move to save some money. The point was made to me by someone in the industry I was speaking to that the money saving wasn't just the $2.75 million, but Baltimore also viewed it as saving $800,000 on the draft pick. So in total, you're talking about around a little over $3.5 million that the team's not going to have to spend. And so it seems like a little bit of money. If I had to guess, I would say Duquette's preference would have been not to have to trade a draft pick. But I do believe that there was some pressure to try and, not have to eat that money, to try and get some of that money back. And they ended up getting all of it off the books. And that's just, in order to give them a little bit of flexibility later on in the year, if they need to take on some salary via trade, and also recognizing that they up payroll this year. So I don't think it's ideal. I think I'd like to think that Duquette's preference would be not to trade that draft pick, but it seems like it was a financial move that there was some pressure to make.
Nick, let's move on to one of the guys that you have hyped ever since he's gotten into the league, and that's Kevin Gausman. What are your thoughts on how the Orioles are dealing with him so in the early part of the season by putting him in the bullpen?
My preference would be to have him starting, just because I think he's got to go through it. He's got to work through it. Making that transition from the minors to the bigs is a lot about being able to make adjustments. I think he's going to have to go through that whole process of turning over lineups and learning to mix his offerings and everything in between as a pro starter. He's not gonna learn that the bullpen. That said, if Baltimore saddled the wrong words, it's never bad to have a lot of starting pitching. But they have some starters that maybe would not be the easiest to move in the off season, and you got some of those guys you're not going to send to the pen. So this is maybe a little bit of a numbers game. I'd like to see Gausman starting, but that's not the way the Baltimore's approaching it here.
Nick, one of the things that we feel that Gausman needs to work on is fastball command, and you've talked about the third pitch, whether it's a pitch that misses bat or just misses the sweet part of the bat, is one thing you talked to us about. Can Gausman, out of the pen going full out, do you think that he can get enough work to really work on fastball command?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you talk about improving fastball command, you're really talking about improving your execution, improving the frequency with which you're hitting your checkpoints and your release point. That's something he can certainly work on in relief. That's something he can work on in side sessions. The question really comes down to if he's going to be used in situations that are a little bit more high leverage situations, seventh inning, eighth inning work. Is he going to have the need to really put game time reps into his breaking ball, whether that's a slider or a curveball? That's a bigger question. He may if he's coming in and needs to get out, he may not have the luxury of making sure he throws four or five breaking balls in an inning. He may have to go rely on that changeup and rely on the fastball in order to get the job done.
And just with the fastball command, since this is something that, as we see with all young pitchers, they've really got to get it down. When you're doing it out of the pen, if your role is going to be as a starter, do you feel, while you can work on it, do you feel that you can't work on it maybe to the level that you need to out of the pen, or do you feel that that doesn't matter, you'll be able to work at it, it doesn't matter whether you're starting or relieving, it's not really going to change much there?
Well, if he's starting and he's getting deep enough in the game that he's throwing, 75 to 100, 110 pitches a game, that's obviously a lot more opportunity to improve on that. And the one thing that he won't be able to work on in relief when it comes to command is learning how to sort of make those adjustments and get your body used to being able to spot your pitches and continue to execute in your mechanics later in games when you start to fatigue a little bit, when the legs get tired, when, you know, recognizing when your arm slot drops, all of that stuff. And he's not going to go, he's not going to go through that in relief. He's not going to, you know, have the opportunity to sort of continue to learn his body, learn his own internal signals as to when he needs to start making adjustments. And, you know, that's an issue. And that's, you know, as I said, that's, part of the whole process of learning to make adjustments and learning how to sort of refine your game at the major league level when you're talking about starting pitching. You know, whether that's a big developmental issue, it's a case-by-case basis. Some pitchers, you know, take to that fairly quickly. Maybe Kevin will have the ability to do that once he transitions back into the rotation. But, you know, it's a reason why I'd like to see him starting sooner than later, certainly.
All right, Nick. So one interesting prospect the Orioles have right now, young guy, I'm not positive how to pronounce his first name. I haven't heard it, but let's see if I get it right. Yomar Reyes, what do you think of him?
You know, he's a power prospect, certainly a really interesting bat. He's one of the, you know, one of the potential impact guys in the system. It's not a real high upside system right now. I think that there are certainly a lot of pieces that are usable, but it's not a system that you look at and say there's a lot of impact here. He's one of those guys that can be an impact bat. He's a ways away. You know, his big issue is going to be just continuing to get reps, continuing to get at bats, seeing pro stuff, seeing pro breaking stuff, and his challenges will come as he climbs the ranks a little bit and starts running into arms that can spot their stuff a little better, can sequence a little better. But yeah, he's definitely an interesting guy. He's certainly someone that clubs are looking at as far as. Potential trade targets. That's someone who, you know, when Baltimore is looking to make a move later on this year, if they continue to be in contention, that's a name that's going to come up. That's a name that teams are already interested in after getting spring looks at him. So definitely a lot of good stuff happening developmentally. Definitely a really good name to know. Be exciting to watch him play this year.
And is there anyone else that outside of like the top 5, 6, 7 prospects, whatever, that is really interesting to you this season?
You know, I think I'm most interested in sort of seeing what Baltimore has at AA and AAA on the pitching front. I'd like to see what these guys do when they get their first taste in the bigs. Obviously, when Cisco is, you know, provided he's healthy, I know he was banged up a little bit and I haven't heard yet, and you guys probably know more than I do, so I've been on the road a little bit here. Whether he's back and healthy, him and Reyes are the two kind of big bats to look at in the lower minors. There's not, to be honest, not tons else in the system that I'm personally interested in. I mean, I'm happy to let the season unfold a little bit and hopefully someone emerges. But, you know, to me, the system's all about those AA and AAA arms and, you know, waiting to see and hope how they do and what they turn into at the major league level. And a lot of those guys are ready to contribute when they get the opportunity, which is another reason why maybe whether you're trading those guys or trading one of your major league arms and opening up a spot for them, it would have been interesting to see the Orioles maybe be a little bit more aggressive on the trade front with some of those assets. That's one of the few areas where they do have a little bit of a surplus.
And Nick, let's get you out here on this. What, as you look at the draft, and I know it's still, you know, what, about 2 months away, what are your thoughts on how this draft is looking right now?
You know, it's a fairly typical draft from a depth standpoint. There's a lot of interesting talent. There are a lot of interesting college arms and high school arms that'll be available sort of from that back of the first round to through the second round, maybe even early third round. A little light on college bats. There's not tons of depth up top, you know, not tons of impact guys. It may only be, you know, one or two sixes out of the crop, and you know, a couple of I guess what I'm really interested in seeing, and part of what really interested me about the Dodgers deal is, you know, we've had Colby Allard with his back issues. It looks like he's not going to be back in pitching until late June. That's a potential top five guy that's going to drop simply because teams don't really know what to make of that back injury, and it's not like Tommy John surgery where there's a, you know, a prescribed treatment and, you know, you have this big track record of, you know, what players look like after the surgery. Teams, I think, are still trying to figure out if they if there's any concern that this is going to be a chronic issue with Allard's back or not, and it could, you know, hypothetically push him deep into the first round, and add to that, you know, Brady Aiken's issues, Maduela's issues, and I think the Dodgers made a play for that extra $800,000 because there could be a potential top five, top ten guy available when they pick, and I think they pick right before Baltimore actually with their first overall pick, and you know, if that's Colby Allard or Brady Aiken, and it takes $3 million to sign them, that's a great spot to have some extra money. So that's probably, for me, the most interesting storyline right now is trying to figure out where some of these, you know, some of the few real big high upside arms that are injured, where they're going to end up coming off the board, because there's a fair amount of risk, but a team that's picking late in the first round could find themselves with a shot at someone who would be a top five pick in any draft.
All right, Nick, excellent thoughts as always from you. We appreciate you taking some time out of your day while you're at the game. Let us know what you have going on right now, Baseball Prospectus.
Well, Baseball Prospectus, obviously they kicked off the in-season coverage. You know, 10 packs every Monday, some prospect updates, and Chris Crawford has sort of stepped in as the lead prospect guy there, and so I'm not entirely sure what he has in store for the season, but I'm sure it'll be something good. There's always a lot of talent writing Baseball Prospectus, and I definitely suggest everyone check it out.
All right, great. And, of course, you can be followed at Nick J. Falaris on Twitter. Thanks again for your time, Nick.
All right, guys. Sorry for all the noise. You can find a quieter space next time.
All right, sounds good. Have a good one. All right, so let's quickly transition from baseball and the O's to the NBA here on the cusp of the playoffs here. Let's welcome Mike Pinna from Sports on Earth, Grantland, a bunch of other sites you write for a bevy of websites, Mike. So how you doing tonight?
Good. How are you?
Not bad at all. So one of the sites you also contribute to is Fox Sports, and I saw that you chose on the James Harden on like the collaborative picks there for FoxSports.com. So why James Harden over Steph Curry and the other candidates?
Well, I mean, you really can't go wrong with a whole bevy of guys. There's Harden, Curry, LeBron, Anthony Davis, Chris Paul, Westbrook. I mean, you really can't go wrong with anyone. You flip a coin or pick a name out of a hat and you're good to go. But I selected Harden just because of, his team finished with in the two spot, and they didn't have Dwight Howard for a majority of the season. Daryl Morey, the Houston Rockets general manager, brought in a bunch of new faces mid-season, and they just kind of kept rolling along with this tremendous defense. And he really was, Harden really was the team's entire attack on offense. So basically every time they had the ball, he was either scoring, getting to the free throw line, creating an open look for a teammate. He did everything. So in terms of being valuable to a team, I just didn't think that anyone else was fit the description.
Okay, Michael. Turning to the start of the playoffs and all, when you look at the Eastern Conference, in your opinion, is it a foregone conclusion that it's going to be the Hawks and Cavs in the Eastern Conference Finals?
Well, I'm a Celtics fan, so I'm not going to pick the Celtics over the Cavs, but I actually, my preseason pick was the Chicago Bulls, and I'm to win the title, and I don't think the Bulls will win the title anymore, but I really think the Bulls and the Cavs in the second round is going to be a really interesting matchup. The Hawks they're banged up. They're kind of hobbling into the playoffs. Paul Millsap's shoulder's kind of an issue, and we all know what happened to Thabo Sefolosha, which is a real bummer. The Hawks will probably get to the conference finals. I wouldn't be surprised, but it also wouldn't really surprise me if they fell early, either to the Raptors or the Wizards, whoever emerges from that series. I think the East is kind of more of a toss-up than people are really speculating, although I would not bet too much money on LeBron James not emerging to take his team to the finals at the end of the day.
Yeah, if it, that was the next question. So if it became Hawks Cavs, you would favor you would favor the Cavs, I assume.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Not to disrespect the Atlanta Hawks, they've had a wonderful season and everything, but they just aren't healthy. And betting against LeBron James in his prime, while he's still in his prime, it's never a smart thing to do. And I know that there's concern with Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love, this being their first rodeo in the postseason, and that'll be interesting to see how they fare. But this team's humming right now on both ends of the floor. They really know what they are, and LeBron did a wonderful job of integrating J.R. Smith, Shumpert, and most importantly, Mozgov into the rotation. And they're definitely a force to be reckoned with.
Do you have any concerns about the Cavaliers' defense? They're ranked 20th, I believe, in defensive efficiency, and I'm not sure if any team has won the title with such a low rating. I could be wrong, but is that a concern to you?
Yeah. So, well, for the whole season, you really shouldn't discount pretty much anything that happened before the All-Star break. Or at least I'm not. So, since the All-Star break, they've had about a league average, slightly above league average defense with one of the best offenses, one of the three best offenses in the whole league. So you can definitely win a title there. They didn't have Mozgov for the whole season, who's kind of their rim protector. J.R. Smith and Shumpert have actually been – Smith especially has been a huge surprise as a wing defender who's really kind of played within that system. He seamlessly rotates, and that's a huge surprise. He was kind of a wild card coming in, but he's played great. And when the starters are on the floor, I believe that their defensive rating ranks very, very high. So, and those are the kind of the guys who will be closing every game. So it really doesn't concern me as much as I thought it would earlier in the season before they acquired Mozgov.
Yeah, I agree. You definitely have to take into account much more so what they've done since the moves and since LeBron's sabbatical or whatever you want to call it, since he's been revitalized. So with that said, we saw what the Spurs, of course, did to the Heat last year, a team, centric team. The Atlanta Hawks, have the former Spurs assistant coach as their head coach now, and they play a similar style of basketball. Of course, LeBron's on a different team now with the Cleveland Cavaliers, but if anything, they're probably even more ISO-heavy than the Heat were. So is there any thought or concern there from Cleveland's perspective that team-style play could defeat the superstar-driven ISO play of Cleveland?
That's definitely a popular narrative that's been floating around. I wouldn't, as good as the Hawks have played this season, I wouldn't compare them to, I mean, the Spurs are the Spurs, and they're kind of on a different level from everybody else. So as good as the Hawks have been, I wouldn't really put them in that category, even though they've tried to emulate the same style, the unselfish ball movement, kind of a motion offense. The Hawks, if everything falls right and they're knocking down threes at a ridiculous rate like the Spurs did in the finals last year, then you just kind of got to tip your cap to them, and they'll probably advance to the finals if those two teams match up. But I would still favor the Cavaliers in that series.
All right, and yeah, I think the Hawks do a pretty good job of emulating the style of play the Spurs have, but they maybe don't have quite as much talent. Of course, they don't have the experience, and they don't have Kawhi Leonard, who of course is key in a matchup against LeBron James led team. So speaking of the Spurs. I think it's generally considered that they are in the most enticing first round series here against the Clippers, even though we could see a lot of Hakka, DJ Jordan going on there. So how do you anticipate that series playing out?
Well, it's definitely going to be a bloodbath, as you kind of alluded to. Two well-coached teams, two really, really good offenses, and at the end of the day, I like San Antonio to emerge, and I would kind of be surprised if the Clippers did, just because they don't have really any depth to speak of. So as the series goes on, and after Chris Paul spent 40-plus minutes in the first few games chasing around Tony Parker, I really think Paul will wear down, and that really becomes a one or two-man team. And if one guy is kind of running out of gas as the series drags on, I don't see how the Clippers can take down the Spurs. They're just too good.
Okay, Michael, I'm curious on your thoughts about the Rockets. We saw Charles Barkley earlier this year talk about how he didn't think they were real contenders when he was going back and forth with Daryl Morey. Do you agree with him, or do you think the Rockets are a legitimate contender?
I wouldn't. So if we're tiering the teams, if we're putting the teams at different tiers, I would probably put the Rockets just below the true contenders. They're just so banged up, and we don't really know what we're going to get out of Dwight Howard, even though he looked fantastic in the season finale against the Utah Jazz. But yeah, if defense schemes to basically try their hardest to remove James Harden from the equation, then they really don't have a backup plan on offense, and that's a huge problem. And Patrick Beverley will probably be out for the whole series. Moti Yunus, who's had a tremendous season, will be out the whole series. The season's over, so they'll be counting on guys like Josh Smith to make plays out of the pick and roll, and they're counting on Howard to be dominant on both ends. And I don't know if that can happen through four straight rounds. But they're a very good team, and I mean, anything can happen. They're in a if they advance, they'll likely play a team that they have not had success against this regular season. So it'll be really tough for them to get out of the West for sure.
With their injuries, do you think there's a chance they could lose to Dallas?
Sure. Really, the only thing that would surprise me in the West is if the Pelicans beat the Warriors. I mean, basically all these series are one team is favored over another, but I mean anybody can beat anybody. With the Mavericks are a very good team. They're veteran loaded. I mean, they've kind of spent the regular season resting up, getting healthy. They're a little thin in the front court, which is worrisome. And Rajon Rondo has yet to kind of look like the all-star point guard of a few years ago. But no, the Mavericks are a very good team on offense, and they've gotten better on defense as the season's gone along. I wouldn't pick them in the series, but it wouldn't be shocking if they won.
All right, so you mentioned the Warriors there. It would be a shock if they lost to the Pelicans. So in the second round, if they face the Grizzlies, who of course have some injury issues, but they're playing the Blazers, who have probably even more injury issues. So if they face the Grizzlies in the second round, and that was a matchup that's been talked about as a potential matchup throughout the year, but a lot of people before Memphis started to slump were talking about it as a Western Conference final matchup. Do you think that Memphis has a chance due to their significant size advantage?
No, I don't. I don't think anybody has a chance against the Warriors. This is a historically brilliant basketball team, and there's really no flaws. There's really no flaws on either end of the ball, and they have this three-point shooting backcourt that is just flame on for four quarters, and a defense that's kind of impenetrable from the perimeter to the interior with Bogut, who didn't even play in the postseason last year. And they're something. They're a very, very good team, and down the stretch of the regular season, they had nothing to play for, and they were toying with teams like the Grizzlies. They blew them out a couple times. So no, I just don't see anybody even coming close to the Warriors until the Western Conference Finals.
All right, so, I mean, I largely agree with that, but just to play devil's advocate for a second here, one potential issue for the Warriors, I mentioned the size situation, is Draymond Green likely having to you know, play a lot against Randolph, which is not ideal for Draymond. Against most teams in the NBA, when he's playing the four, you know, he could, you know, get off pretty easy in terms of being pounded inside. But Zach Randolph, obviously, a very good post-up player. So is that at least one area to be somewhat concerned about for the Warriors?
I don't think so. I mean, we're talking about a guy who's probably going to win Defensive Player of the Year. So if that's your area where you think the other team has exploited a weakness, then you're in trouble. And then on the other side of the floor, Randolph needs to step out to the three-point line and guard Green, and that's just not going to happen. So, yeah, it's really difficult to find any real situation where the Grizzlies would come out on top in that series.
So, Michael, it sounds to me that you're basically leaning towards San Antonio, Golden State in the finals. Is that correct?
That would be correct, yes.
So if that series were to happen, who do you favor in that particular series? And if it is Golden State that you favor, it's what it seems like you were alluding to, do you buy at all into the idea that, you know, that San Antonio would maybe prefer to play Golden State late in the playoffs because they're a jump shooting team and maybe their legs won't be there as much as they would be if you played them, say, in like the second round?
I don't really buy into that. I think you'd want to put off as long as possible. If you're San Antonio, you want to put off as long as possible playing a team that's just as red hot as the Warriors. Anything could happen. Steph Curry could sprain his ankle. You know, that's just kind of so. I would want to put it off as long as possible. But actually, in that series, I would actually side with the Spurs. I really think they match up well on the backcourt, especially where you can put Kawhi Leonard on either Thompson or Curry, and Danny Green, who's a fantastic defender, you can put him on either player as well. And if you make life difficult for those two guys, that's kind of the engine that gets that offense going. And I don't think Golden State will be able to get those transition points that they've kind of lived off of and feasted on all season long. In a playoff series, it'll be a little bit slower. And, I mean, the Spurs are the defending champs for a reason. And Kawhi Leonard's ascension to basically a top five player really puts them back in the driver's seat, I think.
All right, so we'll get you out on this. You have Spurs, Cavs as your finals. So LeBron obviously going up against San Antonio once again. You mentioned Kawhi Leonard. He feels become a top five player, and he's the best guy, I would say, in the league to guard LeBron. So how do you think that series would play out?
I think it would be competitive, but I'm not going against the Spurs. I just can't. Especially, I mean, it's the same group as the last 2 years. Those guys just know how to win championships, and when you look at the Cavaliers, really, there's so much inexperience, and LeBron went to the finals in 2011 with Wade and Bosch the first year, and they didn't win. And this is just a totally different situation where he's older, he's not as good as he was then, although it's a very it's a minor drop off. But then Kyrie and Kevin Love have never been on the stage before, and it's basically child's play for the Spurs. They know what's up. They know what each other are thinking in big spots, and they're almost a perfect basketball team. So, Spurs are my pick to win it all right now. And but anything can happen. I mean, it's just such a crazy season, and the bracket is so crazy, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
All right, great thoughts there. You can be followed at Michael V. Pinna. You want to mention anything you got going on, because I know you work for, you know, multiple websites here. So what do you have going on right now?
So I have this article going up tomorrow on Sports on Earth about it's just kind of I've made up a bunch of fake end of season, regular season awards. So that should be going up on Sports On Air tomorrow. And then I've got some playoff preview stuff up at Fox Sports and Sports On Air. It's coming up later this week.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Mike, and have a great night.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Our pleasure. All right, so there we go. Wrapped up with an NBA guest for, my final guest on Sports Tonight here. So that works out well for me. So, obviously he's big on the Spurs, big on the Warriors too. I mean, for a while there, it sounded like he thought the Warriors were almost untouchable, but then he picks the Spurs. I mean, they're both super strong teams. What are your thoughts on what he had to say?
You know, to me, that's the series. I mean, no disrespect. You know, in the past, I've felt that, the LeBron team is the team that's going to win. I didn't feel that way for the finals last year. Or at least I don't want to say that. I don't remember if I felt that way or not. This year, I don't see it. I feel that Cleveland is, let's say Kevin Love comes back, which I don't think he is, but let's just say he comes back. I think next year would be more of a year for them. This just kind of still reminds me of the first year when the Heat got together. You know, you can get through a weak conference, but then once you get up against a Western Conference team, it's going to be tough. Now, if you were to say that, If you want to say that Cleveland is the odds-on favorite to win the title, which I'm not saying they are, I'm just saying if you wanted to make that argument, because it's more likely that they get to the finals than any other team in the NBA, I actually don't mind that argument. But the Western Conference, to me, does not look quite as strong as it did a little while ago. And it's not because the teams are bad. It's just there are just so many injuries that it's just the depth of the conference isn't quite there. So I think this really kind of comes down to Cleveland, Atlanta. Can Atlanta's team play, as you pointed out? Can the team play outduel the superstar team? And to me, the NBA finals are if San Antonio and Golden State play each other. I think it's fair to say that Golden State will happily root for the Clippers in the first round of this series. My guess is if I'm Golden State, I do not think that either Houston or Dallas will beat San Antonio. I actually think there's a good chance that Dallas beats Houston with all the injuries that Houston has, even though I don't really think Dallas is all that great. But I think that's really the finals in a lot of ways, and I think that's a complete toss-up series. But I think if I were to pick, I think I would lean towards San Antonio too, and I think you can make the argument that Golden State is maybe the better team than San Antonio. They're more complete, but that doesn't mean that matchup-wise that's the best matchup, like Michael said. So I think I would lean towards San Antonio. I did think it was kind of – I'm curious on your thoughts. Do you think that Kawhi Leonard right now today is a top five player in the league?
Top five is – it's tough. I mean, are we counting Kevin Durant because he's obviously not playing? I don't know.
You count Durant, do you think he's top six?
I think he's very close. He's, I think, the best defensive player in the league. He may not win Defensive Player of the Year because, he missed a fair amount of time and all that. But I think he's the best defensive player of the year, or best defensive player right now in the NBA. And he's really come on offensively too. He's damn good. He's right. I think he's right on the cusp of that. I don't think I'd put him in the top five, but right behind that, he's there, right behind like those guys we're talking about in the MVP debate. And he would be in the MVP debate if he didn't have the injuries, I think. So you could argue him over some of those guys. And in terms of who you want to have in the NBA playoffs, again, it depends on matchups and all that, but he's extremely high in that because of the defense he brings. If you're going to go up against Cleveland with LeBron, he's the guy you want. If Kevin Durant was healthy, he's the guy you want to face him. And then even like we mentioned with the Clippers, Chris Paul, he's a guy who can easily guard Chris Paul, wear him out, because he can pick you up full court too. and he's very dangerous in terms of getting steals. So, yeah, he's really good. I mentioned in the MVP debate the plus-minus, and I skipped over number two because the guy he's not in the MVP debate, but that is Kawhi Leonard. He's second in the real plus-minus stat. So, yeah, he's right there. But, yeah, just in terms of who to predict, who's going to win the title, I think the Warriors and the Spurs are the two favorites. So whoever wins that series, assuming it happens, I think is a heavy favorite to win the title. I wouldn't say that it's an automatic that the Spurs beat the Clippers. The Clippers are a top five team in this league, I believe, and that's why I disagree with what you're saying about the Spurs potentially preferring to play them than the Mavericks. I think the Clippers are substantially better than the Mavericks, and I don't really think the Mavericks pose like some huge matchup problem against the Spurs. And, you know, the Spurs would have home court in that series as well, and then they'd have home court in the series beyond that if they were the number two seed, like they could have been if they beat the Pelicans. So, but that's not, you know, super important in the grand scheme of things. It'll be super interesting if the Spurs play the Warriors. Michael's point about Kawhi and Danny Green on, you know, Curry and Thompson is an excellent point. Those are excellent defenders, especially Leonard, as we've been saying. So that poses a big problem for the Warriors. I just think the Warriors overall are just an amazing team. And, you know, Steph Curry, you can't just like be like, all right, Kawhi Leonard is the best defender. You can take him out. I don't think that's the case. And the Warriors aren't quite as reliant on him as, say, like the Cavs are on LeBron. So I don't think he would get worn down quite as much as like LeBron or like a Chris Paul would.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point there is, you know, the Warriors can beat you in so many – they can beat you in so many ways, and let's also not forget this is an excellent defensive team too, which I think is the thing that is overlooked the most about the Warriors is, you know, and you know, who can blame you? You know, you're talking about amazing shooters and a great offensive team that's fun to watch, but you forget how good they are defensively. So that's the one thing. I think the one thing I will say, Golden State is more likely to get to the finals of the conference than San Antonio is. If for no other reason, Golden State is probably playing – I mean, San Antonio is probably playing the third-best team, legitimately the third – not just because they're the third seed, but the third-best team in the Western Conference, so in the first round. So that – I mean, you know, I think you can make the argument, even though the Clippers are better, that maybe the Mavericks have the Spurs number a little bit more so than the Clippers do. But – putting that aside and just looking at the actual team versus team, this is the Clippers are the better team. So it's more likely that Golden State gets to the conference finals and to the NBA finals just because they're not playing the Clippers. And, you know, you like Memphis. Memphis has been a team that we both liked all year. They've tailed off a little bit here at the end. And, you know, Portland, I don't think you can totally overlook Portland either. You know, last year a lot of people were overlooking them against Houston, and they ended up winning their series. So, you know, but again, like was pointed out, there's a lot of injuries for those two teams. And, you know, I think there's a good chance that Golden State gets to the conference finals having played 10, maybe 11 games total, and that's maybe about it. Whereas San Antonio has – maybe had to play, you know, 12 to 14, you know, 12, 13 games. So, you know, that extra rest for Golden State certainly is going to be a help. But you know, it's interesting that Michael pointed out the Curry ankle. You know, the other guy that we talked about for the whole time, this whole season, that's a key is Bogut. Will he stay healthy? So, you know, those are things to watch out for, you know, leading up to the finals.
Yeah, for sure. I think Warriors probably don't play more than 10 games in those first two series. I do disagree a little bit about the Draymond Green thing that we talked about with Michael, but I mean, he's an excellent defender. He's just not excellent in terms of defending someone like Zach Randolph. But I think they still easily win that series. Memphis doesn't shoot well enough, and they've been struggling. And the Warriors are just a tremendous team. First in defense, second in offense, just barely beat out by the Clippers in offensive efficiency. All right, so I have the Warriors actually winning the title over the Cavs. I think you said the Spurs, right? Over the Cavs?
Yeah.
All right. So we have a minute left. You know, my final show. I'd like to thank you, Rob, being a good co-host these past whatever 2-3 years, however long it's been. I'd like to thank Chris Stoner at Baltimore Sports and Life for giving me the opportunity. We've had a lot of great guests on here. You know, really enjoyed it. We've had some good times, really like going, looking back all the way to the best athletes of our lifetime series, back to the message board war days. That was fun. So hopefully the show will go on with you and Chris or someone else. Rob, anything you want to say before we go?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a good time. You know, now we just have to go back to arguing over keyboards again like we used to. So, you know, that's still, it's definitely been a lot of fun for me, you know, and you know, I've really enjoyed doing this.
All right. Likewise, everyone check out Baltimore Sports and Life for tons of great content and just to, you know, see if the show is going to continue. Thanks, everyone, for listening. It's been fun.